Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I am Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Graham Watson, Microsoft Senior Manager responsible for relationships with the global technical professional community. You know, Graham, you have just this amazing history, and you're one of the most engaging senior leaders in Microsoft, and you've got such significant contributions throughout your lifetime. So I know you're really tight in terms of schedule. I really want to thank you for coming in today to do this interview and to share so many of your insights with the audience.
Well, thank you, Stephen. Actually, I'm somewhat surprised to be asked. To my mind, looking at some of the people that you've interviewed before, this is a little bit like being invited on the IT professions equivalent to the Larry King live show. So thank you very much indeed.
Well, it's a real pleasure. And in fact, hey, that's a great comparison, right? Larry King live. I wouldn't argue against that.
Well, as long as you're going, I'm going to be one of your nice guests and not somebody that you grill like mad and try to get to.
Right, okay. Right. Yeah, I'm gonna start raking you over the coals, right?
Oh, thank you.
Graham, you know, as I mentioned, you have this great background. Now, can you profile how you got into computing and what triggered your interest?
Ooh, okay. Well, that's an interesting. To be honest, I don't like cold and wet. That may sound a bit strange, but when I was at high school, there was a choice in one of the classes of either doing cross-country running in winter in Yorkshire or doing computer studies using a brand newfangled KSR 33 terminal to a computer at the Yorkshire School District headquarters. Well, obviously, I didn't really like going outside, and the idea of playing with this computer thing, which was brand new in those days, I am that old, was much more appealing. And a couple of weeks later, I was completely hooked, and by the end of the term, I was actually teaching the teacher on Algol 68, for those of you that remember Algol from so long ago.
Well, that's incredible, because you'd be one of the lucky ones worldwide at that time who would have access to any kind of computing facility.
Yes, thank you for reminding me how old I am, but yes, that's probably quite true. In actual fact, I suppose it was a little bit similar to the situation that Bill Gates was in at round about the same time, that he again had access to a computer locally through a terminal at his school. So same sort of thing, really.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking as well. Now, can you talk about your early years in the computing field and then share some of your experiences?
Oh, dear. Yeah, okay. So we're going to keep going on then about how old I am. Thank you for that. So basically, I started as a computer operator on a Honeywell 6000 mainframe in London. It was actually owned by Honeywell. This was the machine that they used for internal things and for demonstrations and testing and all that sort of stuff. Although the first machine I worked on was when I was still at school, a summer vacation job. It was a Unisys machine, I think. And we actually had to boot the thing, this big mainframe in this massive air-cooled room. We had to boot it by going to the control panel and setting the switches for the first few instructions and then manually executing them by pressing a little button to get it to read the first punched card into the system, which in turn had just enough instructions to get it through the next few, which had enough instructions to get it to read the first deck, which then was enough to actually get the machine started. As you can imagine, that was quite a different process to the sort of thing that we have today. Actually, there's some really strange things I remember from those days. I'm sure there are people even now that are running night shifts in large computer facilities who will recognize some of this stuff. But I remember once I was on a night shift for several weeks together with a couple of other guys. One of them had this really old, greasy motorcycle. And every night, he would, when everybody else had gone home, he'd actually bring this motorcycle into the machine room and start disassembling it and fixing it and repairing it and cleaning it and putting it back again. So there's some tire tracks in the middle of the computer room at times, which wasn't, it was interesting. I also remember somebody once having a little bit of fun with somebody else, and they hid a Mars bar, a chocolate bar, inside a processor cabinet. Now, obviously, hot chocolate and wire-up circuit boards and so forth, yeah, not the best of things going together, and I don't think they've actually found out who it was, but that machine didn't work for a couple of days. Let's think, what else? Oh, I then spent a number of years as what they called a technical engineer, responsible for software support for many, a few mainframes in the UK. And that's when we got into some really interesting high-pressure positions. Like, for example, once myself and a couple of hardware engineers had spent about 36 hours straight trying to get this big mainframe up and working again. It was a hardware problem, but I was just trying to track down, help them track down what was going on from the software issues it was causing. And at one point, we looked up from this dump to find the CEO of this major organization just standing there looking concerned. And he looked me in the eye, and remember, I was only about 20 or so at the time, and quietly said to him, if you could fix it now, I'd really appreciate it. That we actually need to run payroll for the month, and everybody's getting a bit concerned. So that's pressure, is when you have the CEO of a major organization, you're 20 years old, and he's telling you, okay, you've had several days, fix it. So there's a couple of examples. I could talk all day about this, but as you said, I'm sure you've only got a certain amount of tape for this.
You know, that's a really interesting time, right? Back in those old days when you had to kind of literally bootstrap the computers to get them going. And, you know, there's so many stories from that time. Hey, and you lived it, so it's quite remarkable.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Actually, another thing was, I believe that in one of the Star Trek films, at some point or other, Spock goes over to exactly the same set of switches as they had on the front of this system, flips a few bits in one of the registers and the computer, and all of a sudden half the Klingon fleet appears. So computers, they're more powerful than you may think, especially when Hollywood gets hold of them.
Right. Or I'm thinking now of Microsoft Project Natal, which I believe will be released this year, and kind of very magical considering, you know, where you started from, right?
Oh, yeah. The way things have changed is really scary. Who could have imagined that what used to be the size of a large room is now probably not much more powerful than this cheap little plastic watch I've got on my wrist. And the really interesting thing is if you take that and then project it forward another 30 so years, where on earth are we going to be in 2040?
Yeah, that's a difficult question to ponder because...
Oh, absolutely.
Now, looking back over your past, you must have many lessons that you can share, you know, in terms of the responsibilities that contributed to your success or the teams that you've led. Can you share some of those insights, some of those key lessons?
Okay, let's think. So I think actually this, at the end of the day, what I believe quite a lot of people in the technical industries forget is that really at the end of the day, technology is an interesting adjunct to what everybody's job really is. And what everybody's job really is people. It's really all about people. There's a German word, and I'm probably pronouncing this totally incorrectly, Weltanschauung or something like that. But it's a very useful word to remember, probably a useful word to learn how to say as well. Basically what it means is it's the sum totality of somebody's worldview. In other words, this is what somebody, how somebody perceives the world, or how something perceives the world anyway. And I honestly believe that unless you really understand somebody else's Weltanschauung, or again, however you pronounce it, then there's no way that you're ever going to be really able to interact with them properly. And it's something that I see all the time is, and something I probably do all the time as well, is approaching things purely from your own point of view. Unless you truly understand how the person you're talking to sees things, you can't really communicate properly. So I think that's number one, is communicate people and so forth. The second thing I think that's really important, and sorry, these are somewhat more homilies perhaps than key lessons from individual experience, it's the sum total. Second thing is passion. At the end of the day, if you think about it, I'm sure you spend more time working than you do enjoying the fruits of your labor, at least when you're awake. So isn't it important that you enjoy what you do much more than it is important that you earn tons of money or that you're incredibly powerful or whatever? So just make sure that you're doing something that you thoroughly enjoy. At the end of the day, if you're not truly passionate about what you're doing, how can you possibly put your best effort into it? And this is probably going to concern a few people, but if you don't look forward to coming into work, go to work somewhere else. Go to work somewhere where you do enjoy it, because otherwise, what's the point? The opposite side to that, but I think is also important, perhaps, to think about is, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what you're doing. It probably doesn't really matter in the big picture. It's really important to have that mentality simply because if you believe that what you're doing right now is the most important thing in the entire world, you're not going to be able to really take the risks and so forth that are necessary for real success. Because if what you're doing is so incredibly important, then failure becomes extremely difficult to accept. And you need to fail occasionally. If you don't fail occasionally, you can't be doing the best that you possibly can. And often you learn more from failing than you do from succeeding. I think back to some of the mistakes I've made in the past, and trust me, I've made some big ones. But at the end of the day, if I look at where I am now and what I'm doing now and how the world's changed because of my mistakes, I can't think of anything that's really had a tremendously negative effect. In fact, some of the things that I thought were mistakes at the time have been turned out to be really good in the long run. So think about it. What you're doing isn't so incredibly important that it's not possible to take risks, and that taking risks is incredibly important in itself. On the other hand, of course, if you're the person at the control panel of a nuclear reactor right now, please ignore this entire point and do not take any risks whatsoever. It depends upon what you're doing, of course. The other thing I think that's really important, and this is something that I see all the time, and I hope I don't do myself, but you've got to really recognize other people. And what I mean by that is make sure that when you're in a conversation or a discussion or a dialogue or a meeting or whatever it is, that people believe that they're being listened to. Unless somebody believes that you are listening to them, they are not going to listen to you. Why should they? I'm sure everybody understands the simplex and duplex in computer communications terms, but have you ever run across a simplex person, somebody who's only really interested in transmitting to you and isn't willing to receive from you in turn? It's incredibly frustrating, isn't it? If you don't think you're being given an opportunity to contribute, you tend to disengage completely. And you see that in meetings all the time where people start in the meeting excited and so forth and willing to contribute and keen to get the point across, but other people are, perhaps more senior people or just more vocal people, are running the meeting, talking over others and so forth. And eventually you see these other people just completely disengage. There's a really good reason why everybody's got two ears and one mouth when you think about it. It's supposed to be so that you listen twice as much as you speak. In fact, you might want to try this when you go home tonight, or if you're not at home already. Every time your partner or friend tries to speak, talk over the top of them. Actually, try it the other way around. Ask them to talk over you every time you say something. It's probably a lot safer. It's not a good feeling, is it? Try it and see. Actually, don't try it with your wife. But anyway, the important point is don't be Mr. or Mrs. Simplex. Listen. Don't just talk. Next thing I would say, and sorry, this is starting to sound a little bit like one of these commencement speeches and so forth, but make sure that you make others look good. Make sure that people really want to work with you. If you're the sort of person that hoards knowledge and claims credit for themselves for things that they didn't necessarily do, or just doesn't give due credit where it's possible, and note that I said possible, not required, or uses authority because you think it makes you look more important and so forth, why would others want to work with you? Again, think about this thing about wealth and Shang. Think about why would others want to work with you? And others would want to work with you because they enjoy working with you, because they feel safe working with you, because they know that you are going to stand up at the end of the day and say, this person did a good thing, and then you're not going to take their credit. So make sure that you don't take other people's credit and so forth. One other thing, I mentioned that everybody makes mistakes. Make sure that when you do make a mistake, own up as soon as you can. It's far, far better to tell somebody as soon as you've made a mistake so that something can be done about it than it is to keep very quiet and hope that nobody notices. And then sometime later, when it's too late to do anything about it, it's discovered anyway. I can't remember who it was, but there's a very well-known and very senior Microsoft developer at a conference once who gave this wonderful example of a project that he was on. And one of his leads kept giving the same rosy picture every single review on how things were. Yes, we're on track, everything's going fine, and so forth. And then at one progress review, very shortly before launch, this person said, actually, we've got a problem. My feature's about 6 months behind plan. The guy just stood there. This is in a big conference. The guy just stood there and said, interesting, isn't it? This guy managed to slip 6 months in 1 week. How do you slip 6 months in 1 week? Now, of course, that's impossible. He had been behind all this time, but he'd been not saying anything about it because he was hoping he could fix it, which he couldn't. And at the end of the day, that particular project shipped very late, and that person didn't work on that project anymore simply because he didn't say something at the right point in time. So anyway, there's a few key lessons, Stephen. I hope they're useful and not too blindingly obvious.
Well, they're great lessons and very much sort of illustrate all the experience that you have over a great career. Now, can you describe your current role and what you're accountable for? So questions come to mind, things like, how are you specifically helping the IT worker in the community?
Yeah, sure. I've actually sort of almost got two jobs, a little bit schizophrenic, perhaps, I suppose. Firstly, as you're aware, I'm responsible for the global relationship between Microsoft and the technical user groups, mainly through the key independent organizations such as Gitka and Ineta, and also SQL Pass and a couple of other groups as well, but mainly Gitka for the IT pros and Ineta for the developers. And I'm also, secondly, responsible for a program which works with key influencers within the technical community and helps them to be more influential and so forth and plus to support them in what they need. In both cases, though, it's important to know that although I'm responsible at the global level, the real relationships and support and the real work and everything along those lines is actually done by the Microsoft people in the field. My job is basically to do the high-level strategy stuff and deal with the overhead type of things and so forth. So really, at the end of the day, I'm one of these head office overhead people, really. I'm trying to work with the technical community, in particular the user groups and influencers, as we say, to ensure that Microsoft is supporting the community so that you guys got the tools you need to be able to grow skills, resolve problems, build world-class solutions and so forth. And of course, that in turn would help you as a professional progress and grow in your career. I'm making sure that, or trying to make sure that Microsoft is properly engaging with the community so that we can have a dialogue about what you need, what we can deliver, what we're doing right, and most importantly, perhaps, what we're doing wrong in a positive way so that we can actually fix our issues and help you wherever we can. And of course, the other thing, like everybody else at Microsoft, is I'm responsible for promoting Microsoft technologies. Hey, we're a business after all, and you know, somehow or other, Microsoft has to earn enough money to be able to pay me my exorbitant salary.
I like that salary comment. Now, sort of stepping back then, what do you hope to achieve?
So at the very highest level, I think I will have succeeded when there is a incredibly strong, vibrant technical community which everybody's very keen on being part in and which is enthusiastically helping its members with their problems, aspirations, and so forth, and which Microsoft is considered to be an integral part of. Not just as a community sponsor, but also as a community member, just somebody that can be involved in things and talk just as an equal and so forth, and not somebody who is simply a supplier of goods. And I think one of the key things that this needs is that we reduce as much as possible this perception of us and them. Again, that it's not really Microsoft and the community. It's the community of which Microsoft is a member, same as anybody else. And the more that we can have these open, honest, constructive dialogues and so forth, and the more we can work together to common ends, the more everybody's going to be able to achieve. At the end of the day, it's a simple case of just we want to help the IT community as much as possible, be as productive and valuable both to the world and, of course, to its members as possible.
You know, you talk about this whole aspect of having a constructive and open dialogue, and I guess that's something that I really do see clearly every time the different people in Microsoft engage with the broader community. They say, you know, we're really part of you or part of that greater community, and, you know, we just want to add value and, you know, what are the issues, what are the challenges, what are the things we're doing right, what are the things we need to do better. And it's really nice to see that kind of ability to say, hey, we want to help, right? So I like that. I like that sort of genuine part of that.
Yeah, I'm actually extremely pleased to hear you say that. I think one of our big issues, in all honesty, as far as this is concerned, is a very simple one. It's that although Microsoft does have quite a lot of people, it's still not that many. And not everybody in the in our community of users and people affected by Microsoft technology ever has an opportunity to just sit down and have a chat with somebody from Microsoft. I only wish that could be the case. I'd buy everybody in the world a coffee if I possibly could, but unfortunately there's not enough of us.
Now, you mentioned that you'd like to buy everybody a cup of coffee. You can't. So let's go to the next step. What are the best resources that are available that you would recommend that allow people to engage with Microsoft or see what you can do and so on?
Okay, well, I think in general, and again, let's just think about community as a whole for just for a second. I think probably the most valuable resource that anybody has is the people around them. There's other people, there's nothing to beat other people in the community for the ability to just talk about issues, talk about things that where you need help, talk about things where you can give help, and so forth. And again, this to some extent maybe even comes back to the point I made earlier about this developer who just kept quiet about his issues until it was too late to do anything about it. But there's nothing to beat conversation, dialogue, brainstorming, just talking through issues and so forth. And the people around you is are probably one of the most important resources that you can ever have. So I think that's number one, probably actually number one, two, three, four, five, but I'll give you some more as well. Obviously, the second thing I'd say would be tools such as TechNet and MSGN and so forth. At the end of the day, the ability to just go onto the web and get onto either TechNet or MSGN, depending upon what your issue is, and quickly find solutions to problems. And actually, TechNet, MSGN, and general web searches, obviously using Bing, but general web searches and stuff like that. I was actually installing a machine yesterday, and I had a couple of issues with device drivers, and in about 2 or 3 minutes, I got them fixed. And as I was doing, I think, you know, if it wasn't for the fact that I had there were network problems. If it wasn't the fact I had another machine here where I could quickly go into the network and find from other people's experience what the solution to this was, this would have taken me all day. So, TechNet, MSGN, use the search, Luke, is probably the next key thing. And this also is almost the same as the next point, which is the general technical community. Community groups, in particular, I think, are a great way not only to find that level of technical resource and support and so forth, but they're also a great way to build your network of people that you trust and rely on, and also provide a revenue for you to share your skills and help others. So I would actually strongly recommend anybody who isn't part of the technical community, either whether being part of a user group or multiple user groups or actively contributing on forums or whatever it happens to be, if you're not engaged in the community, trust me, you're missing out a lot more than the community is, but take part. I already mentioned the internet searches and so forth. As I say that, I think it's incredibly easy now to find information compared to what it used to be like. And then I'm actually going to go back for the last thing to almost the first one. The first one I mentioned was this thing about working with the people around you in the industry. The last resource I'd say is also think about the people around you outside the industry. I actually think at times we get far too wrapped up in our own little world and so forth, and you know the wonderful technology and the whiz bang things that we can do and all that sort of stuff. But sometimes it's important to stand back and ask, so what? What is it that I'm doing that's so particularly important? And it might be worthwhile just occasionally finding somebody who has nothing to do with the IT industry and trying to talk to them about what you do and trying to get their viewpoint. It might ground you a little bit. It might get you to, might make you realize that this particular thing, which you've spent the last couple of months working on and has been incredibly challenging, is far less important than this simple little thing that you knew full well that you could do and just wasn't a big issue. It was, you just didn't get around to it because you didn't think it was important. Talk to people outside the industry. So I think they're the key resources at the end of the day.
You know, I can sort of personally think about sort of the value of joining user groups and the broader technical community. I belong to an organization called KIPS, another one called EMPA. I belong to another organization called IFIP, IP3, the ACM, the IEEECS, Computers for Success, the Neil Squire Society, and you know, the list goes on. But really, the value that you can contribute, but what you also get back is just, you can't define it. It's just, it allows so many different kinds of opportunities. Your life is so enriched. So I really recommend that the audience go out and look at Gitka or Ineta and their user groups or all the other kinds of associations that are out there, that they, you know, so they can participate, they can be heard, and they can contribute to the, you know, the greater dialogue. It's a great opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, when you think about it, when you're trying to build your skills in something, I think there are actually effectively really three stages. The first thing is when you try and learn about it, when you read about it and so forth. The second stage is when you use it, when you do something. So, for example, your first stage may be picking up a book on Silverlight and reading about Silverlight and just sort of poking around and reading articles and just general research. The second stage may be where you get a copy of Microsoft Expression and actually build your first Silverlight app and so forth. And by the time you've built two or three of these, you think you're extremely proficient. And you may even be, after that second stage, be at the stage where you think, hey, I'm a Silverlight developer. I know Silverlight. I'm the bee's knees. The third stage, to my mind, and probably the most important stage is, okay, if you're that good, teach others. It's only when you try and teach others what you think you know that you start to really understand that perhaps you didn't know all you thought you did. So get involved with the community, give something back, teach others what you know, and perhaps from that you will learn a lot.
And I also seem to recall a major study done or a paper produced by Gartner where they indicated that if you want to progress in your career and have even more and more opportunities in career growth and growing your skills and opportunities, managing change, making connections are sort of a big driver for IT workers out there. Their recommendation was, why not try volunteering or getting connected with a nonprofit group or a trade organization in your community? Because there's just so many opportunities for personal growth and doing that engagement. And often there's many leadership positions that you can also take on as well. So really every part of your life can be enhanced by contributing and volunteering.
Yeah. And actually another thing to think about, especially bearing in mind the current economy, which hopefully is slowly starting to improve now, but the people that you work with on a day-to-day basis are the people in the same tend to be the people in the same general economic situation as far as the company is concerned as you are. So that if the only interaction with people who could use your skills are the people that are directly related to your current role, what happens if, heaven forbid, because of the economy, your company has to downsize or something along those lines? If that company is downsizing, that probably means there's less work to do with the people that you currently know. It's important to build relationships outside your current work environment, just in case that sort of thing happens, quite apart from anything else, so that you have an alternative set of people that you can talk to if you do need to find something else to do or to talk to other people or whatever it happens to be. Just having that second level of contact is incredibly important, and that's one of the things the community can really help with.
You know, a big part of our discussion right now has been about user groups or having a bunch of IT workers get together and form a group of a community of some sort. So that kind of leads to this other question. You know, you have a number of people who are IT professionals and workers, and they're interested in forming a community, being a user group. So then what allows that group of people forming that user group or association or society, what allows that kind of formation of this community, you know, what makes it like sustainable and scalable, self-sufficient and cohesive? You know, what's the glue that'll keep those people together?
Obviously, this is, bearing in mind my job, this is something that I spend a lot of time thinking about, and I spend a lot of time asking myself the question, okay, so what can Microsoft do to make these community groups more sustainable and so forth and just thrive and grow? And in all honesty, the answer to what can Microsoft do, the answer is, well, we can't. At the end of the day, Microsoft can't really make a group of people into a community. It's the group themselves that has to do that. But all that Microsoft can do is provide them with as much help as possible, a good environment, for example, so that to help them to be all that they can be. I mean, we can provide a number of things, such as we can provide publicity through our websites and so forth and various other mechanisms to make sure that they're well-known. We can even provide a little bit of funding in some cases so that we can help them with a few initial meeting expenses, pizza, beer, that sort of thing. We can provide them with some content to talk about at meetings. We may even be able to help connect them with speakers so that they've got someone new and exciting to listen to at their meetings. We could provide connections with other people in a similar situation to help mentor them. And actually, we can also, primarily through organizations such as Gitkur and Inetta and so forth, provide some resources such as maybe access to SharePoint web hosting, live meeting accounts, BPOS accounts, that sort of thing. But the thing that really makes a group of people into a vibrant community is enthusiasm and availability of the core members of that community. If there aren't a reasonable number of people within that community who are really keen and enthusiastic and keen and willing to get involved and help drive the community, and also those people, need to have the time and so forth to do that, there's nothing that we can do as far as providing resources and so forth are concerned that can fix those key things. So at the end of the day, it really is all about having a few, or hopefully a number of, key individuals within that individual community who care, who are really keen to make that community work and have the time to be able to put in to do so.
You know, there's members in the audience who may not be familiar with the terms GITCA and INETA. Hmm. Can you further define those?
So actually they're both just acronyms for a couple of organizations. GITCA is the Global IT Community Association, and INETA is the International .NET Association. And actually, the other one I mentioned earlier was PASS, which is the Professional Association for SQL Server. Each of these is basically are basically umbrella organizations which user groups or technical groups in turn can join. So these associations, GITCA, which is primarily for the IT professional side of the house, INETA, which is primarily for the developer side of the house, and PASS, which is primarily for the database side of the house. Actually, we need somebody else so that we have four sides of the house. But those organizations are actually organizations that user groups or communities themselves join. They're not, you as an individual would not join GITCA, for example. Your user group would join GITCA. And the main reason behind these organizations primarily is to help the user groups or the leaders of those user groups, with whatever they need so that their user groups are successful, and to connect people together, help them find the resources and so forth, and also act as a global voice for those user groups. In fact, in some ways, not entirely, but in some ways, you can almost look upon them like a union. If you think about these organizations as being the union of the user groups, then it makes it easier for the user groups to speak as a whole back to Microsoft, or perhaps to other organizations, maybe IBM or Apple or whoever it happens to be, different organizations. So we believe that GITCA, INETA, PASS, and these other organizations are very important, because what they do is they raise the reach, effectively, of the 10-person or 20-person user group in some small town in Central Asia to the level where everybody can hear.
You know, Graham, you talked about you had three parts or three walls to this house. I just thought of a fourth.
Uh-huh.
And that would be this UN-founded IFIP,
yes,
organization, which stands for the International Federation,
yep,
for Information Processing. And then they're also like an umbrella, and they have, in this case, member societies and associations that belong to this international group. So,
yeah, I think IP3 is a very interesting organization, actually. And obviously, although you know a heck of a lot about it, being one of the founders to a large extent of the entire group, I think it's worthwhile just quickly talking about this for a few seconds, just in case others haven't heard about them. IP3 is the International Professional Practice Partnership, and it's part of IFIP, International Federation for Information Processing, which I believe is a UNESCO body. But the purpose behind IP3, actually, I should let you say this because you're part of the board, but I'll say it anyway, and then you can tell me how wrong I am. But the purpose really behind IP3 is to make sure that the IT industry has not only has the infrastructure and so forth for true professionalism, but also that the members of the IT profession are seen as true professionals. As an example, I've actually been in the computer industry for a long time. When I started, I think we were perceived a little bit as mad scientists. If you remember all those old films like Dr. Strangelove and so forth, where the computer operators would walk around in long white lab coats, and you'd look at these big computer rooms where there are computer tape reels spinning backwards and forwards for absolutely no reason whatsoever, usually. And there were usually weird noises coming out of these big computers, probably because they were broken or whatever. It sounds like it, anyway. Nowadays, everybody has at least one computer. Many people have several. In fact, thinking about it, my three kids probably have about let's see, they've got about 6 desktops, 4 laptops, they've each got a couple of mobile phones. So, everybody has so many computers nowadays, it's scary, in fact. Thinking about that even hurts. The big problem, though, is because it's so ubiquitous, I think the technical industry is becoming perceived to be more like a plumber or an electrician. Not, there's not anything wrong with being a plumber or electrician. In fact, when you need a plumber or electrician, you realize they're the most important people on earth. But at the end of the day, we've lost that cachet, that perception of being a professional career as opposed to being a technical trade. When you think about it, actually, at this point in time, if you were to be a plumber, there's probably more requirements for certification on being a plumber than there are on being an IT practitioner. So we need to be able to recapture this perception of being expert, qualified, professional, and a key component of the business, not just of technology, but of the business as well. And in particular, I think we need to be seen as a group of people who can have business value rather than just being a business cost. And this is one area where professional qualifications can be very, very important. Think about a chartered accountant. This is an example somebody else from the IP3 board gave me. If someone was to become a chartered accountant, that's got real credibility. There's at least one top 10 company, probably most of the big organizations, where they throw this big party in the entire department for every single person in their staff who becomes a chartered accountant. They then basically get significantly better compensated. They get all sorts of particular improvements and so forth to their status within the organization, partly because being a chartered accountant makes them in turn significantly more valuable assets to their company. Now, turn that around and think about asking your manager's manager to throw you and your entire department a party and give you a significant pay rise and grade rise and so forth the next time you pass an MCP exam. Probably not going to happen. What IP3 is doing is making sure that there is a globally recognized professional set of standards where people can regain that perception of being a valued professional. So actually, Stephen, as you're a significant part of the body, do you agree? Did I get that right?
Yeah, I think you captured it very well. And the fact that, you very eloquently sort of commented on the need for IT professionalism, this concept of IT being a recognized profession with a code of ethics, with based on a standard body of knowledge, with credentialing and professional societies or associations in countries around the world providing support for this, all within sort of this umbrella of the IP3 or this International Professional Practice Program. Mm. And, yeah, you very eloquently described that, and really there's a need for that going forward of IT being a recognized profession. And, you've indicated support and belief in the system. Microsoft has also provided their support. Can you comment more on about that?
Well, I think that basically Microsoft supporting IP3 is really just it's just something that's incredibly obvious to us. Again, for the same reason as before, when you think about it, Microsoft's lifeblood is the IT professional. I'm sure everybody's seen the YouTube videos of Steve Ballmer in a total fervor, running up and down the stage, shouting out, "Developers, developers, developers!" Well, I agree. I mean, really, Microsoft is all about its developers and its IT professionals and it's the people that use our technology, and the architects and the designers and everybody else that uses our technology. The more that we can make sure that these people are perceived as a critical part of the business, a critical value add to the business, the more it helps Microsoft. So being totally mercenary for a moment, IP3 is good for Microsoft because IP3, we believe, is good for our customers. And if it's good for our customers, it's good for us. So we'll do anything that we reasonably can to support the profession. In fact, I believe that we actually awarded Charles Hughes I can't remember what the exact award is, but whilst IP3 was being founded, Charles was invited to a dinner with Bill Gates and was presented with an award for all the work that he's done. And actually, this is, I suppose, really for IP3 as a whole, but he was the representative. All the work that he has done, that IP3 in turn has done for professionals. So yes, we are totally behind IP3.
Well, that's
You should mention who Charles is, just in case people don't know.
Yeah, Charles Hughes is the first chair of the IP3 task force, and the task force was given this directive of implementing IP3, this concept of IT as a profession backed by demonstrated, professional competence and demonstrated professional development, adherence to a code of ethics and so on. So really a remarkable initiative supported broadly around the world. Mm. So I really appreciate your answer too. That was pretty full, a complete answer. Okay,
it's one of those things that I'm passionate about.
Well,
remember what I said? If you're not passionate about what you do, go back to bed.
Okay, well, why should the technical community care about Microsoft programs?
So why should the technical community care about Microsoft? I'm going to make this short, and it's a bit controversial, an answer perhaps, but the technical community shouldn't care about Microsoft programs. And I'm sure there's no end of Microsoft people listening to this going, what's his phone number? But really, you as a IT professional, as the technical community, shouldn't care at all about specific Microsoft programs. What you should be caring about is, what can you get out of the programs that we're running? What can you tell us to make us change our programs so that you can get more out of them? Because at the end of the day, the reason we run various different programs, whether the program is, for example, something like the funding that we provide to user groups, or it's something like the big tech ed conference that's going on right now in San Diego, whatever it happens to be, these programs are there, let's be blunt, for two reasons. One is to support you in the community, and the second is to help us get as many people as possible adopting Microsoft technology. Now, you shouldn't care about the second one particularly, unless you're developing and you need a big audience. The one you should be caring about is, what's in it for me? And so look at the Microsoft programs that we run, work out what's in it for you. If you don't like what's in it for you, tell us and get us to change it.
And I guess that speaks to the fact that Microsoft is always listening to the community and wants that open dialogue that you talked about earlier.
Yeah, absolutely. I've always had a personal belief that if I've got a problem and I don't tell you that I've got a problem, then it's purely my problem. How can it be your problem if I've not told you? So make things Microsoft problems. Tell us.
You know, one of the terms that I hear bandied about a lot is this concept of an influencer. Now, what does that mean, and how does that relate to Microsoft?
Ooh, now that's an interesting question. Influencer. At a superficial level, it's really easy. At a superficial level, an influencer is simply someone who affects the opinions and actions of others. However, when you start to look into it further and think, okay, well, so that's basically what an influencer is. So what makes a good influencer? How do you see how influential somebody is? How can you help somebody be more influential? That sort of thing. It starts to get very difficult very quickly. I actually think there's four key factors to being a influencer. The first one is volume. And what I mean by that is, how much does this person say? Is this somebody who is communicating a lot via email, communicating a lot on blogs or Twitters or on Facebook or on any of the plethora of different social spaces now? Or are they somebody that speaks a lot at web conferences, that sort of thing? So volume's number one. The second thing is relevance. You may be the world expert on beer brewing, but that's not really interesting to Microsoft. So you may be a very influential person in the beer brewing space, but Microsoft as a whole doesn't care. Actually, I'd like to talk to you because I brew beer as well, but it relevance is the second thing. The third thing is reach. How many people hear what you say? And again, this is really important now, much more important perhaps even now than it used to be, because of social media and the fact that you can be talking into a void, perhaps. So let's go back to the beer brewing person. If I'm a world expert on beer brewing and I am putting out new fresh content on beer brewing every single day, but nobody knows, so therefore I'm not reaching anybody, who cares? Then the last one is reputation, and that's probably more important than any others to some extent. If I was to write an article on writing XNA games to run on Windows Phone 7, I doubt it's going to have much impact, because I have absolutely no reputation at all for writing XNA applications on Windows Phone 7. In fact, I've never done it, and I would have to work out how to do it from the basics. So even if I'm, even if I decide to send a whole pile of different pieces of content out about XNA games via emails and blogs, Twitters, and posting on Facebook and this sort of thing, and even if I actually did know a lot about this topic, simply because I've done a lot of research on it recently, and even if a lot of people actually got those communications, if I wasn't known as somebody that knew what I was talking about, again, my level of influence is going to be much less significant. So those are the four key things: volume, relevance, reach, and reputation. If somebody can think of a word beginning with R that means volume, I'd be quite grateful, because then I'd have the four R's. Anyway, basically, to be a truly world-class influencer, you need to have all four of those. If it's you, and whatever you say is relevant to Microsoft, and then it's likely to have an effect on us, either positive or negative. So that makes you somebody who is a very important influencer as far as Microsoft's concerned. And obviously the same rules would apply for anything. I remember seeing this poster, this little sign in a number of different restaurants, actually, and it was quite a good one. It said, "If you enjoyed your time in our establishment, please tell your friends. If you didn't, please tell us." And that same thing would apply here. If you're somebody who's very influential and you are enjoying your time in the Microsoft space, please tell your friends. If you're not, tell us and let us fix it.
Now, we talked about community before, earlier in this conversation, but let's get to some specific tactics. Let's say I'm an IT professional. Mm-hmm. What can I do to get involved with the community, and how can I contribute?
Okay. So I think, firstly, you'd want to do this because you should be thinking about how to give something back for everything that you've received from the community in some way or other over the years. And secondly, there's a heck of a lot you can get from participating as well. So you can give something back and you can get something from being part of the community. If you've been in the industry for any period of time at all, you will have benefited from the altruism of other people. Whether you recognize it without thinking about it or not, you are standing, everybody in the computer industry is, to use the term, standing on the shoulders of giants. Your account's overdue. It's about time you put something back. Now, having said that, I'm sure that's not true of everybody, and I know there's a lot of people, such as yourself, Stephen, who have spent so much time putting things back into the community that your account is in wonderful balance. The other thing is that there's a heck of a lot to be gained from participating, and we touched on some of these already. Firstly, you can build a strong network of contacts, not just the people in your current industry area, or the people that you work with as part of your job, but outside that area as well, and that's always, as I said earlier, a good thing in certain times. You can build your reputation as an expert by helping people, and you can actually learn a lot, as I also said earlier, from teaching others things that you may think you already fully understand. A good example of that, think about the topic which you're probably best known for being an expert in at work. Now go and tell either your parents or your children about it, and watch the glazed look on their face, and then realize that you may not as fully understand your topic as you think you do, because if you fully understand it, you should be able to describe it to anybody. And using the community as a way for doing this is great. Oh, and of course, there's another thing. You can have great fun. I mean, basically, going to some of these meetings, meeting these people, talking about interesting topics. What's better in life? I actually love this idea. There've been books and films about this, but I like the idea of all these community-minded IT professionals wandering around the globe, spreading random acts of unsolicited kindness to other people in the community.
I like that. Now, Graham, I know you're going to say when I ask this next question that I'm not the best person to ask. I'm not an expert, but come on, you've been in the industry for so long. You've got a great brain. You're one of the most successful people I know of. You know, you're just an amazing person. You are at the hub of a lot of different kinds of technologies and solutions that are available. So that's why I'm asking you this question. Now, what specific key solutions and technology should we watch for coming from Microsoft, and why should we care?
Okay, give me a couple of things to think about that one. Microsoft technologies. As you correctly mentioned, although I used to be much more into the deeply technical side of things than I am nowadays. I'm much more focused on the community now. I think some of the things that I personally find particularly exciting from the Microsoft space at this point in time are things such as Azure or Asia or whatever. It's a hard word in that it means different people pronounce it totally differently. So Azure, Silverlight, I think is tremendous. If you've not done any, if you do any development at all, and you've not done any development or looked at Silverlight, I strongly recommend you just go to Microsoft.com, pull down some of the free kits that are available to help you do Silverlight development. Just write something. It's really cool. Obviously, the Windows platform as it progresses, I think Windows 7 is a tremendous operating system. I also think that some of the, well, not some, all of the capabilities within Windows Server R2, 2008 R2 are fantastic. The Windows Phone as well, all the things that are progressing as far as the Windows platform is concerned, I think is very interesting. And also, the way that we're getting involved with and building into social computing and so forth, I think all of those are very interesting. And I think the combination of Azure, Silverlight, the Windows platform, including the phone, and all the stuff that's going on in social computing is an incredibly powerful set of technologies that we're working on. Ubiquitous computing is a term that's been around forever, and it's meant many different things to many different people over the years and so forth. But I do think we're slowly getting closer and closer to IT being just almost simply part of the environment. And I think that some of these technologies that I mentioned are things that could be a real force in that whole area. And if you're not involved in any of those, get involved.
Now, Graham, I'm going to ask you to just give a one-sentence description of things like Azure, Silverlight, Windows Phone 7, and so on.
Okay. Azure or whatever is a combination of a number of related technologies which allow people to develop and host and run applications in the cloud. And the cloud, of course, is another one of these buzzwords, which basically means run in on somebody else's system. They run on the internet in a data center somewhere, and you've no idea where it is. Is that a sentence? It'll do. Silverlight. Silverlight basically is a set of technology that allows you to develop extremely rich, interactive, and engaging applications, either web-based or even that run on your individual machine, in a way that not only captures the heart of the user and is much more easy to use, but also is incredibly easy to develop and very powerful to develop. I obviously don't need to describe the Windows platform. Windows Phone basically is one of the things I'm really looking forward to being able to get my hands on. Even though I work for Microsoft, sometimes we don't get this technology that quickly internally. Customers come first. But basically, I'm actually looking at some extent Windows Phone 7 as being Silverlight in the palm of my hand. And as I say, find out about Silverlight and you will realize how cool that is. So those weren't one sentences. As always with my answers, they're a bit rambling. But
you know, something that I've read about recently is this whole Windows Live environment, and there's some great, exciting things happening there. And I know it's really designed for the consumer space, but I could see big adoption in the business space as well, because there's just so many tools and solutions that are available that it's just so natural and easy to use. Can you say anything about that whole Windows Live environment at all?
An interesting thing I think about Windows Live, and actually about the differentiation you just made between consumer and the business world, is that I'm not entirely convinced that the consumer world and the business world are as clearly separate as they used to be in the past. When you think about it, I'm sure you do the same as me. When you finish at work, you go home, you take your work laptop with you, and then you sit at home and you continue to do odd bits of work whilst you're at home. And I'm sure I'll admit to occasionally doing odd bits of home when I'm at work. The two environments are very much blurring, much more so than they used to be in the past. Some may say that's not a good thing, but whatever. And I think the same thing you can almost say also apply to things like Windows Live. For example, the current Gitka site, website is actually at the moment hosted on, Microsoft Office Live, which is designed for really small businesses and so forth to be able to very quickly put up a website, or even for individuals to put up family websites and that sort of thing. In fact, I actually have a little family website myself on using Office Live, but we're using it for Gitka at this point in time. Other technologies, such as, for example, Live Maps. We're using Live Maps to help people find where user groups are. So the differentiation between Live being consumer and things like Azure and Silverlight and so forth and all the other things I talked about being business, I think that's a very blurry line nowadays.
And I guess everybody's familiar with things like Hotmail and Windows Live Instant Messaging, and there's Photo Gallery and Movie Maker, and the list goes on.
Well, that's an interesting question. I just wonder how many people are familiar with all these things. I mean, I frequently find out about cool Microsoft stuff from my friends outside work who come to me and say, hey, you work for Microsoft. Can you tell me more about X? And I think, what the heck is X? And then I find out about it, and I think, wow, that's really cool. I had no idea we did that. I would actually suggest that people might want to do things such as just occasionally go onto Microsoft.com and just sort of generally have a route around and see what they can find that's interesting, or go to live.com and see what's going on there, or of course read some of the trade press, or go to a user group meeting.
And something else that I'm seeing, and I'm seeing this in the Windows Live environment and also in Office 2010, is this sort of social media integration. Mm. I think it's just so cool.
Yeah, I find that the social media space is a very interesting one, but I actually think also to some extent it's at the moment in the same state that the PC industry was in the, the home PC industry in the late 70s, when, you know, for example, when we had all these different computer systems out there, there were literally tens, if not hundreds, of different operating systems and tens, if not hundreds, of different types of computers that people could buy for home or even for work and so forth, with the result that it was very difficult for developers to develop to a one or two platforms. It was very difficult for consumers to know which one to get so they could work with their friends and so forth. And I think that at this point in time, the social media space is very similar, that there's all these different solutions out there, most of which work to some degree or not with each other. And there's a lot that could be gained, and I'm sure will be gained at some point, from one or both of two things. One is a significant reduction in the number of different solutions out there. The second one is some sort of a clearinghouse type of thing, so that, for example, if I wanted to say, when you think about it, if you want to communicate with people, what you really want to do is you want to communicate with people. You don't want to Facebook them, Twitter them, blog them, whatever else it happens to be. You want to communicate. And if we can get social media to the point where it's all about what you're trying to do, rather than all the different methods of doing it, then I think we've got a big win.
Well, I kind of see that happening with Windows Live, right? Because they're trying to amalgamate all the kind of feeds into, you have this one center where you can manage it all and see it all. And so you have this sort of one experience. I just love those kinds of things that are happening.
Yeah, so you're quite right. That's what one of the things that we're attempting. The problem is it's a little bit of a Sisyphean task, that you know, it's a bit like rolling the boulder up the hill, because each time we manage to connect with something else, then there's another two or three things we need to connect with as well.
Right, and I mentioned earlier about this Project Natal, which is this add-on to the Xbox, and I know people are sort of thinking that's gaming, but I can just see so many business applications for it, where you can have this sort of telepresence experience, and I can see corporations buying it for that reason. And
absolutely. To my mind, actually, when you think about it, and perhaps I shouldn't say this, but I've not heard this from inside Microsoft. This is just purely me thinking myself. But I'm just thinking it would be a cool thing if televisions actually came with a Natal device baked into them. Because think about it. If you were actually sitting in front of the TV, and maybe you could even get to the point that when an advert comes on for something that that seems interesting to you, you could just sort of wave your hand in the air as though you're asking a question at a conference or whatever, and the tower would work, oh, look, this person's interested in that, and then we then swap from the television program to some sort of interface with the advertiser where they can say, oh, that particular car that's just been on, I want to know more. Could you either arrange for a test drive or send me some literature or whatever it happens to be? And that's just one example. I can see that, Natal, as you say, there's so many possibilities here.
Now, there's probably people in the audience who don't know what Project Natal is. Can you describe the experience?
Well, I've only seen the stuff on the internet as well, so the best way for people in the audience to find out is probably just to go to the Internet Explorer and use Bing. Sorry, I had to do that. And type in Natal and see what it tells you. Natal. But basically, what Natal is it's a combination of a set of camera type devices which project out from a screen and basically can see your movements. Add that to some software, and the software then is able to convert the image that the camera sees of you into gestures. So, for example, at the one level, there's this idea of me just raising my hand in the air and waving it about to say, I would like your attention. At another different level, for example, in the Xbox scenario, you could perhaps at some point in the future, and again, I have no idea if this is going to happen or not, you might be able to take part in the next version of Halo, and rather than having a controller and having to press buttons and so forth, you could actually just pretend you've got a gun in your hand or pretend to run, and Natal would recognize that the motion that you're making is aiming or the motion that you're making is running or whatever it happens to be, and your character within the game just does it because the computer is now able to understand what you yourself are doing.
You know, I'm an older guy, and I see these racing games where you have to manipulate a console or a controller, and it's just so complicated. With Natal, you just put your hands up in a steering position, and you just turn your hands, and it drives the vehicle. I mean, anybody can do that because there's no training required. Or I saw this video where they have two people conversing, full screen images of two people conversing. It's almost like you're in the same room, and somebody says, by the way, what outfit should I wear tomorrow? And the one person A says, well, here, I've chosen an outfit for you. Why don't you try it on? The second person just literally grabs it in the air, moves it onto her virtual body, which is on the screen, and then as she turns in real time, the image is turning with this new outfit on. I mean, it's just, I can't believe that kind of experience. It's just amazing.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that Natal will open up so many possibilities that the opportunities are almost boundless. This whole idea of, what did they call it, augmented virtual reality, where you use a combination of a computer and a Natal device, or they've done it similar things, but nowhere near successfully in the past with just ordinary cameras, but a combination of a computer and Natal and so forth to actually be able to interact directly with a computer rather than having to use keyboards or controllers or whatever it happens to be. There's all sorts of possibilities, limitless potential. I also wonder, though, when there's also almost limitless potential to get things incredibly wrong if you don't think through your scenarios properly.
Right.
But remember what I said earlier. You've got to fail occasionally, so try it.
Hey, Graham, I got to put you on the spot. You're in Redmond. I need to have a day there so I can do a story when this is released.
I will see what I can do. As I say, that's not my area at all, but Stephen, you're more than welcome to come down whenever you want, as I'm sure you know, and I will see if I can get a connection with the Natal team.
So let's going back to our theme of our discussion today, maybe open it up here, you know, sort of what are some of the interesting questions that you get asked and what are your answers?
Well, that wasn't one of them. sorry. I think the questions that really get, again, rather than talk about specifics, the questions that get me excited are the ones where they open up something I'm particularly interested in. And perhaps they challenge me in ways I hadn't considered. So, for example, the whole question about Natal, I hadn't really thought too deeply about the possibilities and so forth. And the example that you gave of using it in order to interact with somebody about, for example, what they're going to wear tonight and that sort of thing. That's a really interesting question because it's something I'm interested in. It challenges me about things I hadn't really thought too much about. And it's the start of a stimulating discussion, or could be if we had more time. And also, I think a good question is one which isn't necessarily judgmental. You know, it's not a case of, why on earth did you do that? It's more a question along the lines of, I wonder what opportunities there are here. That's the difference important. And the other thing is, at the end of the day, the questioner also has to be passionate about the subject. If the questioner is passionate about a subject, if it's something that I'm interested in, if it opens up the possibility for thinking more about it and so forth, that's an interesting question.
So let's try another stab at a question then. What are some challenges that you were not able to overcome at the time, and how would you do things differently now?
Right. Well, actually, when you think about it, almost every challenge can be overcome in one of three ways. It can be overcome by changing things. It can be overcome by just having lots of tenacity and so forth and keeping on and on about it until it's resolved. Or it can be overcome by time. Remember, as I said earlier, at the end of the day, nothing ends up being anywhere near as critical as you think it is eventually. The biggest issues I've usually had have been around getting sufficient support for ideas, which I'd consider both obvious and brilliant, not necessarily my ideas, obviously. And the problems I've had have usually come from that perception of this being so incredibly obvious and we've got to do it, that I assume that everybody else sees things the same way as me, and everybody else is as on board as I am. Without going into details, because I still work with most of these people, I think what I need to do differently in those cases is spend more time really, again, go back to Weltanschauung, really thinking through their worldview, their Weltanschauung, and working out if they really do see things the same way as me, and if they don't, adjusting my viewpoint or their viewpoint until we both see things the same way. So the challenges that I've had tended to have been because I've made assumptions about other people being as excited about things as I am, and then not getting people bought on board because I thought they were already. And again, no specifics there, but I think that's where the real challenge for me has been in the past, has been not everybody is necessarily as enthusiastic about things that I'm enthusiastic about as I am.
Yeah, those are some good points, and we're down to our last few questions, and I'm really curious about this, you know, looking into your past, looking at where you are today, and even sort of the crystal ball into the future. Can you name people or events that inspire you, and why is this so?
Ooh, okay. So I think the first one actually is, to my mind, incredibly easy. I've not actually met this person, but he really is a true inspiration to me, is Stephen Hawking. He's a man with more significant challenges in his day-to-day life than hopefully any of us will ever have experienced or will ever have to experience. Yet he seems to be, to me, accepting of his current situation. He addresses it the best that he can. Despite all this, he's managed to be at the very pinnacle of his field, and he's moving humanity as a whole forward in his level of understanding, although I think a lot of the stuff that he's doing is stuff that we may not see any practical benefits for some while, but he really is a true inspiration of, it doesn't matter how bad you think things are, here's a guy who shows that you can work through just about anything. And of course, as I say, he's obviously thoroughly enjoying his career, despite all his problems. So I would say he's the first one. The second person I would put down on this list of true inspirations, and here I'm very fortunate, I suppose. Well, I am very fortunate. It's my wife. She's in a lot of ways extremely different to me, and that in itself is good. But Anne is the sort of person who always puts other people first. And having somebody like that to try and measure up to is very valuable. Anne's the sort of person who, if she was on the Titanic and it was sinking, she'd go down with the ship. And the reason she'd go down with the ship is she'd insist that the captain and the band got off before her, and assuming they were determined to stay, she'd stay as well, just to make sure they're comfortable and so forth, and to make them a nice hot cup of tea and that sort of thing. And that level of altruism and that level of putting other people first, I think, is a tremendous standard to try and live up to. And I'm never going to be able to do it, but it's great one to try and do. Once I get past those two people, though, I think we get to the point of there's so many other people who could fill a potential third or whatever position. I'm going to leave any future positions beyond one and two to be announced. I did actually, I was aware you were going to ask this question, actually, and I did spend about 10 or 15 minutes looking at the lists on the internet of the top 100 people in the world as true inspirational people and so forth. And they had people like Abraham Lincoln on there and Gandhi and all this sort of thing. And I thought, well, yeah, and they are, don't get me wrong, they are, but this was a list of 100 or so people, and getting it down to the one or two that were really inspirational was very difficult.
You know, I'm just thinking of this story that involves you, and I know that one of the organizations that you're affiliated with, the community organization, was going through a major upgrade technically, and you were due for vacation, and you postponed your vacation, and your wife accepted this as you were helping that organization on your own time move to the next stage. I mean, just that's inspiring.
Well, you know, you've, absolutely. As far as my wife is concerned, fortunately, she still did manage to go on vacation, by the way. She went with some friends of ours and so forth, and those. I was the only person that personally suffered, I suppose, from that. But again, this I think really comes down to comments I made earlier about do something that you're passionate about. If you're not really passionate about your job, do a different job. And you know, this was something I'm passionate about, and it's something that had to be done. And sometimes you think, okay, we have to do this. Just get on with it.
Now, looking back over your career, what are some lessons that you want to share with the broad audience?
Wow. Okay. So this reminds me a little bit of, there was a song, it was quite popular a few years ago, which I believe actually came from a commencement speech that appeared in a newspaper article that somebody wrote some time ago. It's something to do with, it's a song about wearing sunscreen, and I'm sure most people remember this. But you might want to look it up, and perhaps, Stephen, afterwards, you could, if you post this anywhere and not just throw it away, you could actually find the links and put the links with the article. But there's some really good pieces of advice in that song. The one I particularly like was there's a thing there about do one thing every day that scares you. And I actually think that's really good advice, because otherwise, if you stick within the things you're familiar with every single day, it's not that good. There are a couple of other lessons that I think are really important. And again, I've really spoken about some of this already. Number one is give others due credit. Make sure that people are willing to engage with you, willing to work with you, keen to work with you, and that people actually get what's due to them. Give other people's credit. A personal one for me is, and I still need to be better at this, but write it down. I've learned that I always forget things, and if I don't write it down, I'll forget it. So write it down. And the third thing is, just remember, it doesn't matter where you are today, it won't be as bad or possibly good tomorrow. Time changes things. Time makes things less important.
Now, what phrases do you live by and find interesting?
I always liked a statement Arthur C. Clarke made a long time ago, and I think this comes back to our comment earlier about the way that technology is still progressing. And it was something like, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And when you think about things like Natal, or even think about some of the very simple things that we take for granted today, a lot of the stuff that we now just take as, you know, oh yes, just technology, nothing special about it, is really stuff that only 20 or 30 years ago would have been considered magic. And I think that stuff that's going to be happening in 20 or 30 years' time will be what we currently think of as magic. So I think that's a really important thing to think about, is that any sufficient advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. So never assume that anything is impossible. It's just all it takes is time and a bit more of this magic, otherwise known as technology. My second phrase perhaps is one I saw on a number of bumper stickers and so forth, which I think, because I'm a geek and a male, the one I liked was, he who dies with the most toys wins. And that's what my wife hates the fact that I try to live up to this at every possible opportunity. He who dies with the most toys wins. And then, it's not a phrase, but I hope a single word counts. This comes back again to this word that I've been using a little bit, and probably mispronouncing, and that's Weltanschauung. Think about other people's worldview. it's not the definition of the word, but first seek to see things through other people's eyes. If you don't understand where they're coming from, how can you have a conversation with them?
You know, those are some good phrases. Now, we're down to our last question, and here you get a free wheel. Because I'm going to ask you, what do you see as some of the top challenges facing us, and how do you propose they be solved?
Okay. Seeing as we've talked so much about technology, I'm going to cheat a little bit and talk about something that's nothing to do with the IT industry at all. And it's just a personal little bugbear of mine, and it's absolutely nothing to do with Microsoft, it's just me. Everybody, and in inverted quotes, everybody, keeps going on about global warming and pollution and poverty and all these sort of things. And don't get me wrong, these are all very real issues, and I worry somewhat about the world we're leaving for our children. However, it's amazing to me how one key thing never really seems to come up in the discussion about all of those important topics, and I think it's critical. I believe that there are too many people on the planet. Now, I'm not suggesting that we remove people from the planet, but there are too many people on the planet. I think that's one of the main reasons why there's global warming, why there's pollution, and even possibly why much of the pollution in the world, much of the poverty in the world exists. But instead of addressing the real issue of too many people in the world head on, we seem to be putting most of our time, resources, and angst and so forth on fixing what I believe are really symptoms instead of the cause. Now, just to repeat, this is just my personal opinion, and I have no expertise in the area whatsoever, and I have no really good suggestions as to what to do about it, but I really do think, firstly, we need to acknowledge this as one of the key root causes of the problems of global warming, pollution, and so forth, before we spend vast sums of money trying to fix the symptom rather than the problem. Anyway, seeing as you've got me wandering off, and this is much more lighthearted, but I'd also like to know, how can we get drivers to indicate what they intend to do instead of what they've already started to do? It's a bit late to indicate, right, once you're halfway around the corner, and put that phone down. Your call isn't that important. Now, the last two, obviously, I had a hard driving to work today, but there you go. I'll calm down now. One thing, perhaps computer-related, and this is very much from personal experience. So I moved to the States in 2000. Shortly before I moved, I made what's possibly a big mistake, and I gave my parents a computer, which I thought would help us stay in touch and this sort of thing. What I've realized since then is that we're still a long way from making computers truly useful for the average user. Now, I'm not talking about any particular system or any particular application or anything along those lines, but after innumerable transatlantic telephone conversations trying to get my father to get his computer working, or some fairly tense conversations with my wife on similar things, it's obvious we need to spend more time working with the more elderly people, such as my father, or the less techno-savvy people who really don't care about technology and just want to use it to do stuff. We haven't still really got to the point where computer systems are just totally intuitive to people who aren't familiar with computer systems. Sorry, you let me ramble.
Well, that's interesting. You know, when I interviewed Chuck Thacker, who received the Turing Award this year, and he commented that his wife talks about this whole aspect of, you know, computers should be just really transparent. Like, you shouldn't see them at all. It's like in your car, you don't realize that there's probably, like, you know, dozens of computers running things. It just should totally be seamless.
I agree. I agree. We should be concentrating more on what people are trying to do than on the technology that they're trying to do it with.
Well, Graham, that's the end of this interview, and, you know, I really enjoyed talking with you, engaging you, sharing your stories, your insights, your wisdom. You're looking into the crystal ball. You're describing your work with the community, and we went off into topics about Microsoft technologies and upcoming technologies and just general kinds of challenges that are facing us. And I, you know, I really enjoyed this time, and, you know, considering your extensive history of successes, you know, we are really fortunate that you came in to do this interview, and I thank you for taking the time.
Well, thank you, Stephen. I've actually quite enjoyed this, and I look forward to hearing from anybody that actually bothers to listen to this. Let me know what your opinions are. I'm always keen to talk to people. Thank you, Stephen. And thank you, whoever's listening.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Graham Watson, Microsoft Senior Manager responsible for relationships with the global technical professional community.